G'day, Tony. My name's Robert Burrows. I live in Australia in a small town called Daylesford, although I'm in Melbourne at the moment. My life was motivated by the fact that my father had two brothers. They were both killed in World War II. My father's older brother was named Robert, after whom I'm named. He was a prisoner on the Montevideo Maru, a Japanese prisoner of war ship sunk off Luzon, coincidentally on the 1st of July. Yesterday for us in 1942. And his twin brother was a wireless air gunner on a Beaufort bomber that was shot down over a bow on his first mission. So when I was a kid, I was just interested in this whole question of we went off to the Shrine of Remembrance every year to remember his brother's service and the fact they died at such a young age. And the year I turned 14 in 1966, I decided that I wanted to spend my life working out why humans are violent and developing strategies to end it. And of course, the good news is when you're 13 or 14, everything feels possible and fairly straightforward, and you're just going to knock it over in a few years. Anyway, I'm still at it, and I believe I have a lot better understanding of why humans are violent now, why that manifests, how it manifests, and the just the sheer dimensions of it, I guess. So I became very interested in both understanding it but also developing strategies. And in 81, I did a lot of research on Gandhi and his nonviolent approaches to conflict in India during the liberation struggle there. And I spent many years researching nonviolence. So, yeah, by about 96, I didn't have the answers on violence I wanted. So Anita and I spent 14 years in seclusion, taking apart our own minds so that we understood the psychology of violence as thoroughly as we could by understanding ourselves deeply. And by the time we'd coupled that learning with my earlier learning on nonviolent strategy, I published a book on that back in the mid-90s, put us in a pretty good position to understand the various dimensions of violence, how to address it in various contexts. And just because of the effort to understand violence was something that was always so strong for me. Even as an undergraduate, for example, I'd come across the concept of a global elite. Read a book by C. Wright Mills called The Power Elite in about 71 as an undergraduate. And so I've sort of followed what the global elite gets up to on and off, you know, really since that time. Any issue where violence is a key factor, I've certainly been interested in. And consequently spend all my time now really just analysing what's taking place, taking it apart, trying to understand it deeply, and then giving people options for addressing it powerfully that are non-violent. Because,
well, yeah, the only thing is, of course, the war machine is an almost relentless juggernaut. And, of course, there is a sort of problem at the heart of this, isn't there? And that is that you've got these various factions around the world, nation states and, you know, empires, groupings of countries, and each of them realizes that in order to expand, it's got to be, you know, acquisitive to find new resources. It's going to have to bash up against another one, going to try and grab resources. I mean, something, for example, was going on in Syria, is various countries sitting around Syria are thinking, great, now that country's been smashed to bits, we can go in and grab some of it, you know. So, but the thing is, you've got that force, but then you might say, well, actually, what we need is a kind of peaceful global force. But the trouble is, you've also got a globalist force as well, which is also intent on using violence to effectively take over the world. So how do you balance those two, the idea of having individual nation states and then a kind of globalist force, which wants to have a world government, you know, and everyone doing what it tells us?
Yeah, well, I think, again, as you'd expect, Tony, the answer to that question is complex and multifaceted. In coming to grips with understanding why humans fought wars, obviously we ended up analysing a deeper question, why humans violent in the first place, because war in the end is only one symptom of many, unfortunately. And really, this world is an incredibly violent place. It's been violent, really, pretty well since the Neolithic Revolution, when it really got going, I think. And the problem is that because of the way we socialise children, we teach them from a very, very early age, and this is pretty comprehensive. So perhaps some Indigenous societies miss out on the worst of it. But we basically terrorise our children into learning how to be violent as a response to conflict in virtually any context. And so,
well, how do we do that? I mean, the schools don't, do they? That's not at least what they're supposed to be up to.
Well, no, I agree. It's not what they're supposed to be up to. But because human beings, in my view, don't really understand what causes violence in the first place, it's very hard for them to make sound decisions about how to address it. So, for example, you know, if we've got kids locked in school for 6 or 7 hours a day, then it's a prison for children. Most children aren't even given a choice about whether or not they go to school. So, I mean, obviously, for a start, that's not going to encourage an approach to life in which people are being considerate of themselves and others and thinking about the wider ramifications of what they do.
Yeah, but the kids are there to learn. I mean, you know, the idea is, look, this is for your own good.
Yep, well, I know that's the idea. I'm just saying it doesn't work that way. You can't lock a child in school 7 hours a day for 12 or 13 years or 10 years at minimum and expect it to learn how to be a civilized human being, in my view. It's just not possible.
But don't
people come out of school
children,
very violent.
Don't children actually quite like just being together? You know, they actually like the idea of being away from the parents. They have quite a bit of leisure time when they're at school. And you know, a lot of kids actually really look forward to going to school.
Yep, that's because they've been socialised from birth to be submissively obedient.
Okay, so what about the COVID-19 pandemic? This is something which kind of came up on the horizon March 2020, not long after there had been some real serious wobbles in the international financial markets the previous year, and also the Brexit, which was formally took place on the 1st of January 2020. A lot of us in the UK think, well, gosh, this isn't this funny, isn't it? We just thought we were going to get a little bit of independence and be able to do our own thing after Brexit, and this comes along where everyone's locked in their own homes. But what do you make of the whole way this has rolled out across the world, and particularly obviously where you are in Australia?
Yeah, well, I think if you look at world history, Tony, it's pretty clear that you know, really going back about 12,000 years, we've had ongoing struggles between a global and elite. Local initially, more national as time evolved, time went on, more global, certainly since the middle of the 20th century, continually trying to assert and extend its power. And you've had a, you know, reaction against that by those of us among the ordinary human population who want to have some liberty, some rights, some capacity to make choices about our lives that are consistent with what we want rather than what the elite wants. And so, you know, if we look at sort of human history, at least for several thousand years, you can identify this continuing struggle between the elite, local again, or national or global, whatever, and the grassroots population. And all that's happening at the moment is we're seeing, if you like, the latest manifestation, although it could be pretty close to the end game, where you've got a global elite really attempting to assert complete control over the entire human population. And the roots of this go back at least 50 years. You're familiar with the Bilderberg Group, for example. I know, very well aware of it, and you know how these sorts of plans have been discussed at one level or another, you know, at least since the early 70s and in earlier versions before that too. So all that's happened at the moment is that under cover of a supposed pandemic, on a virus that hasn't even been isolated and proven to exist, the World Economic Forum has launched what it's called the Great Reset, which has been planning for years, just another part of an ongoing agenda, and you can see strands of it in Agenda 21, Agenda 30, and so on. And the final pitch is being made really now as we speak, and has been for the last year and a quarter, to assert this complete control over the human population. And so all the key elements of the Great Reset are designed to make certain that the elite gains complete and final control. And if we don't resist that strategically and effectively, we'll be basically locked in prison cities and monitored daily and pretty well have total control of our behaviour exercised by forces outside our understanding.
Well, I'm afraid, Robert, there's not a lot of doctors that would agree with you that this virus doesn't exist. They've seen patients dying with it. What makes you think that people will believe you when you say things like that, when they, for example, have lost loved ones?
Yeah, well, I think that's part of the problem, Tony. One of the most powerful tools at the disposal of the global elite is, of course, the corporate media, which is exercising enormous control over the narrative that's being promulgated around the world, and certainly a key tool in making certain that this coup can proceed. The simple reality is that no doctor or scientist has ever offered a proof for the isolation of a virus with the name SARS-CoV-2. Anyone is welcome to search the literature. You can read any medical journal in the world that you like. No, there is no demonstrated proof. This has been demonstrated by any number of doctors and scientists. They, of course, are not reported in the corporate media. So whether it's Andy Kaufman or Sayed Qureshi or John Rappaport, all sorts of researchers have just demonstrated time and again that the virus has never been isolated.
Well, hang on, because how can you demonstrate that something hasn't happened? Because certainly if you look up, you will find all over the internet, there's lots of research, for example, the printing of the genome, the publishing of the genome. I think it was initially by the Chinese at the end of January 2020, so that researchers around the world could look at it. The analysis of that publication, for example, at New Delhi University in the beginning of February 2020, where they said that they believed that this SARS-CoV-2 could not have appeared naturally. And there's also this ongoing investigation, which Fox News have been pursuing, amongst others, into the Wuhan laboratory, Peter Daszak, etc., and the idea that there was an American-funded program there that produced this virus from the Wuhan lab. What makes you I'm puzzled as to why you think it's worth pursuing this idea that the virus doesn't exist.
Well, I think the problem for me, Tony, is actually fairly simple. Everything in the world is something that can be investigated. And the basis of everything that's happening at the moment is, in fact, this lie that a virus with that label is causing deaths around the world. And it just feels really important to me to start by trying to tell the truth, even if there's not much of an audience for it, and encourage people to go off and do an investigation of their own.
Well, if you do an investigation, what you'll find is that the SARS-CoV-2 has been grown in tissue culture. The virus has been grown in tissue culture. It's been also multiplying, obviously, in vivo, which is in live human people, although it doesn't really seem to have much of an effect in people under 60, other than being like a flu. It certainly has a flu-like effect on those over 60 and has been killing them in a similar sort of way to the flu, even though the way that it works on the body is SARS, which is something completely – well, it has a similar looking effect, but it's a completely different process going on inside your body. SARS is leaving all that aside, and whether or not there is a virus –
Can I make one quick comment, Tony?
Yeah.
One quick additional comment. There's a group that in April last year offered a 100,000 euro reward for anyone, any scientist in the world, who could provide a documented proof of the existence of the virus. Okay, 100,000 euros. That reward has not been claimed. It still stands widely known. Not everyone knows about it. I'm happy to admit that. Widely known, and it hasn't been claimed. There is
I could send them the exact genome published by the Chinese. Would I get my 100,000? I doubt it. Anyway, look, the point here really is whether or not there actually is a virus is that it has had an enormous effect on the planet. And I think my own view is that it is basically like a very strong flu, this particular virus, but it's not of the flu, and therefore the protocols that have been being used to treat it in hospitals have not been the correct ones, and so people have been dying at an incredible rate of knots because the insurance companies won't allow the correct treatments. That's what the hospitals have been doing. But what is it, do you think, that it links this to this great reset? We're in the month of July now, 2021. A big announcement, you know, even last year they were talking about this. We're going to have a great reset. Is there anything that you can say to sort of link the pandemic to the great reset at all?
Look, from my viewpoint, Tony, the evidence is overwhelming. The whole virus is the cover story, the distraction from the deeper agenda. And again, if you look at the literature going back really 30 or 40 years, this whole idea of using a virus as a basis for getting this sort of control over the human population has been discussed, and you know, it's plenty of it there in the literature. It's been one of the ideas they've floated for how they get everyone to sort of submit. The powerful idea behind a virus is that it was designed to scare individuals in a way that even a war can't scare individuals, because most people can stay well away from a war, particularly if they live in a European or Western country. So they might finance a war by paying taxes if you're an American, for example, or an Australian, or you know. But the average person doesn't end up in a war. But if each individual is personally scared that they will be attacked by a virus, then you've got an excellent chance of getting them to submit.
Okay, so have you got any actual reference to some time in the past where this has been openly discussed and published, that this is what is being planned?
Well, I think, again, there's a difference between what's openly published and what's planned. You've got to look at some pretty some pretty obscure elite literature to find reference to this. But again, people like John Rappaport have been paying attention to this for 40 years, and he's got some pretty solid documentation. So I'd suggest people, if they're interested, can have a look at some of John's work.
Okay, so the idea is to use a virus to take away people's civil liberties. But what about this connection with the Great Reset? Because I was fascinated that when it all started, all this COVID lockdowns around the world, although not in some countries like Belarus, for example, who said that they were bribed by the IMF to have a lockdown and they refused, to actually link it with the Great Reset, because it was all kind of announced almost at the same time.
Yeah, well, I think that's my point, really. The virus was always, as I say, the cover story. The elite coup, called the Great Reset, if you like, had been planned for years and was, you know, just introduced conveniently after this, you know, virus appeared and was such a threat to the human population as it was presented by the corporate media. Again, if you look at the history, I mean, the elite has enormous control, including over national governments, which is why most of the governments of the world went along. Two that didn't go along had presidents assassinated, Burundi and Tanzania. So the point is that as long as the elite could control the narrative through the corporate and government media and get governments to comply, which, again, basically what I think 192 went straight along with it, only four dissenting initially, they've just been able to implement this coup, which obviously has enormous ramifications for human life and human society. And that's now being implemented progressively in a number of ways, both in terms of how it's restructuring society and everything from land use to what individual rights will have. So to me, the virus was the cover story. The Great Reset is the real story. And that's a reshaping of human society, but it's to achieve elite ends, nothing that's good for ordinary human beings. And there's many elements of that which we can talk about if you like.
Well, yeah, okay. So this is what I'd love you to do, if you can, Robert, is just to pick out one or two of the selling points, if you want, of the Great Reset that Klaus Schwab, the World Economic Forum, Prince Charles are using, and explain what you think is really going on.
Yeah, well, I think it's being sold as a chance to reset, you know, the economy of society, if you like, in order to make it, more consistent with how we need things to be as things are unfolding for a new future. it's 2021 after all, and so they're telling us that, you know, things need to change rather profoundly if we're going to take into account certain ecological parameters and so on. But in fact, there's a much deeper agenda, which again is much less talked about, but clearly available in the literature, and many good analysts have exposed it. For example, the deployment of 5G, apart from the, you know, onerous burden that's going to impose on life generally on Earth because of the extra electromagnetic radiation it's going to generate, is going to enable comprehensive surveillance. It's going to enable digital ID to be, as part of the agenda, digital ID will be implanted probably in our brains or sprayed up our noses or given by vaccination, whatever, and then the 5G will enable that to enable this comprehensive surveillance. Well, that could be linked to your bank account and health records, the digital ID, that is, creating a social credit ID, and that'll end up dictating every facet of your life. There'll be digitization of money, which you're obviously well aware of, robotization of the workforce and the military, really a complete transformation of what it means for government. Forget democracy, that's already gone. I don't know anyone who voted for these lockdowns. Energy and finance will be transformed, real estate, policing, how we interact. So the reality is we're sort of heading towards a technocratic society in which, if you like, transhumans will be heavily monitored, heavily controlled, and probably confined in smart cities linked to the so-called Internet of Things. And we'll have a bunch of 7.5 billion slaves on the planet following the orders of an elite at the top that's got us doing exactly what it wants. And that's assuming those, you know, we all survive, because there's plenty of evidence to suggest there's a pretty strong eugenics agenda running through this, meaning that, you know, they're hoping to knock off a fair share of us. And the evidence of that's coming out, even with the vaccines already killing lots of people.
Yeah, but surely, I mean, you know, there is this thing called human freedom, and the human spirit is rather difficult to just crush like that. I mean, there's quite a lot of people who are just going to say no to this, surely, Robert.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you, Tony, and that's the good news. A lot of people aren't going to take it lying down, although at the moment it's probably still a pretty small proportion of the population. And my own concern is that just having people say we're not going to put up with this isn't going to be enough, because the elite has enormous resources at its disposal. Apart from the financial control it'll be able to exercise over us, it also has police forces and the military forces. And it also just has a population that's pretty submissive, as we touched on right at the beginning, because the reality is a lot of people are submissively obedient, and they're not going to ask too many questions because they're being bombarded by, well, in your case, the BBC and the newspapers and social media in England, and telling them a particular story. So with a submissively obedient chunk of the population, the corporate media to make certain that there's a consistent narrative presented, and with police and military backup, we're going to need a pretty sophisticated strategy, and not just those humans who are able to stay in touch with their desire for freedom and to resist it at a superficial level. So, you know, my interest is in getting us to respond more strategically, because I think that's going to be really important if we've got any chance of succeeding.
So what about these characters who are supposed to be in charge of this great reset, although one does wonder if they are sort of front men to a certain extent, that is to say, particularly Prince Charles? I mean, he's in a bit of an awkward situation here in Britain. He's not very popular. A lot of people believe that Princess Diana, his ex-wife, was assassinated, murdered, rather than just died in a convenient accident, and that, of course, he would have had to have sort of given the nod to that happening. So there's particularly a lot of particularly women in Britain that don't really see him as a fit kind of leader to have. So there is him, and there's also this guy Klaus Schwab. So what do you make of these characters, and are there any others do you think that we should know about?
Well, I think you're hitting the nail on the head there, Tony. I mean, not many of these people are the sort of people we see as what I'll loosely call popular leaders, you know, the sort of people we want to represent us, and they're certainly unelected in any form or fashion. I think Schwab and Prince Charles are perhaps two of the figures who are on the front line, along with people like Bill Gates, Elon Musk, and so on. But to be candid, in my own view, I think there's a deeper elite, more important people in the background who are pulling the strings of even these front people. And their names, I'm sure you're familiar with, who are much less inclined to have their name out in the public, in the media, but who prefer to sit in the background and pull the strings. So my own view is that there's a front line of the elite, if you like, that doesn't mind being public, and there's a background elite that actually has the power and pulls the strings.
Okay, so well, what can we expect this year then, do you think?
Well, I think unless we start to resist strategically, I think things will just continue to, if you like, get worse. That is, there's not really any sign, and I don't think too many people think they're seeing any sign, that this elite coup is going to sort of back off. I mean, when it first started in March last year, you know, we had a six-week lockdown in Australia, for example. I think that was pretty common in most countries. And we were told, oh, that's to flatten the curve, or whatever the expression was at the time. And, you know, once that happens, we can all get back to normal. And then I think we're up to about four lockdowns in Australia now, ranging from the 6 weeks to, it varies from state to state, but from, say, 6 weeks to about, you know, a few days. But I don't see any reason why this should go away unless we can resist it effectively, because we know that we've got Cyber Polygon coming up on the 9th of July. This is probably the final rehearsal of the collapse of the financial system. The Great Reset documentation itself, I don't know if people have looked at the
Sorry, what is this? What you just mentioned there, Cyber Polygon? I've never heard of that. What is it?
Right, Cyber Polygon's this will be the final rehearsal, I would imagine, on the 9th of July. This is an initiative of the World Economic Forum and the one of those US, what's that US NGO that does peace? I can't think of the name, but anyway. Two organisations, a prominent NGO in the US that's supposedly about peace, the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, that's right, the Carnegie Endowment for Peace and the World Economic Forum, are rehearsing a collapse of the global financial system. That's what Cyber Polygon's about. Now, given that Event 201 was a precursor to the whole COVID narrative, you know, we can assume that maybe Cyber Polygon's benign, but that's probably not a wise assumption. So there's definitely talk about collapsing the financial system with the specific intention of doing two things. One, to force us all onto digitized currency, which means the capacity for their control of us will be enormous. And secondly, to hide the sort of malfeasance I think we're all aware of that's gone on through some of these financial crises in recent decades, which you mentioned earlier. So this rehearsal will happen on the 9th of July, and the only question really is whether it's going to lead to a fairly imminent collapse of the financial system, or one that'll drag out a bit. People like Catherine Austin Fitz talk about this with considerable authority. She's a prominent American financial analyst who's on our side, if you like, the people's side. The problem is that all I'm saying is that this whole Great Reset thing, it has enormous depth and detail. If you look at it, it talks about changes in 200-odd facets of human life. Now, most of us would struggle to get past 10 or 20 facets of human life. They've got details on changes they anticipate, 200 areas of human existence. There's no sense of that going away for any reason, and if this Cyber Polygon type thing happens in the real world, we're just looking at further and deeper consolidation of elite control of human life, human society, human population generally. So, as I've said before, you know, if we're not able to resist that strategically, then I think we're in for really the second dark age, and that's assuming we escape extinction, given the threats on that count, which are separate altogether.
Right. Well, I mean, there's been a lot of talk about climate change. We know your last summer over in Australia was pretty horrendous, wasn't it, with all these bushfires. Aren't there quite a lot of people in denial about this? Climate change is absolutely real. Something needs to be done about it, surely.
Oh, look, I completely agree, Tony. I think the evidence on what's happened to the climate is overwhelming. I mean, we've had recently at Mauna Loa in Hawaii, the CO2 level in the atmosphere was measured at 419 parts per million. Started off, what, at about 275 at the Industrial Revolution 270-odd years ago. So there's no doubt that there's too many measures. I mean, glaciers are melting. People know all this. And we can pretend it's not happening, but that's not going to deal with it. Obviously, human society is very energy intensive now. We're burning fossil fuels. We're taking the carbon out of the ground, if you like, and putting it in the atmosphere. And as I say, that is one of various things that's driving us in a very horrible direction. Biodiversity collapse is another one. Doesn't have much of a profile, but these things are all genuine threats. And I think, you know, we can deny it, but you don't have to look too hard if you're really looking at scientific evidence to realise that, these are genuine threats and we need to address them systematically and carefully. And we need to get people involved and onside and understanding the depth of it.
Now, I know you've got this 7 days campaign to resist the Great Reset. Can we really do that in 7 days? What's the strategy? What do we do?
Yeah, sure. Well, I want to emphasise at the start that we're not going to do it in 7 days. It was just a way of sort of packaging the strategy in a way that felt sort of manageable. So there's basically 7 key ideas, and we just linked them to a day of the week so that people could get the idea. Okay. But we do need to do them all the time, and we're going to have to do them for a while to succeed. And I just want to emphasise that what this strategy is about is it's giving people ideas so that they can non-violently, non-cooperate with what the elite's doing in order to shift power from the elite back to us. So that's what it's about. It's about non-violent, non-cooperation to directly shift power from the elite to implement this coup and give it back to us. And so we came up, I actually originally wrote a list of about 39 strategic goals, and Nita reckoned that's a bit too long. So she said, how do we shorten that? And so we've done that, and we presented it on a website called We Are Human, We Are Free. And just quickly, I'll go through them so that people get an idea. So we linked this to Saturday, but this is not something to do on Saturday. It's something to do all the time. First of all, we need to refuse taking the test that they're offering us to see whether or not we've got COVID-19, and particularly resist the experimental injections. There's a lot of literature on vaccinations and how damaging they are, and a lot of adverse impacts that have been documented over the years. That literature is not widely known, but there's certainly plenty of stuff coming out now because of the whole COVID thing. And I think people are probably aware at some level that a lot of people are dying from these vaccines, and that's well documented.
What about things like the polio vaccine, you know, are talked about as a brilliant thing that's eradicated polio almost completely?
Well, what the people who've done a lot of research on this, and I'm not pretending I have, but I've done a fair bit of reading with people who have, suggest that vaccinations have never worked. What's happened is that vaccinations have tended to be introduced at a particular time in history, but that time's coincided when there was a massive improvement in, for example, the health and well-being of the population generally because of poverty alleviation programs, even things like introducing sewerage or clean drinking water or teaching people to wash their hands have had an enormous impact. Because the vaccines is sort of based on what's called the germ theory of health rather than terrain theory, there's plenty of evidence to suggest that people who eat healthily, live in a healthy environment, and follow pretty basic precautions are not likely to get sick. And if they do, the answer is to reverse what they were doing wrong rather than to have a vaccine. Given with these ones, we've already had, I think Europe had 12,000 deaths from the vaccines officially by the end of May. I don't know where it's up to now, but in the US was about 5,000. So this is deaths from the vaccines that are supposed to be there to help us. And that's not counting the adverse effects otherwise. So the first day is refuse the injections and any testing, because that way you're not playing into the game that there's a problem here that we need to resolve.
Yeah, okay. I wonder if we can run through the other 6 days a little bit quicker, please.
Sure, no worries, mate. Second one, don't buy 5G upgrades, resist anything to do with the fourth industrial revolution. So that's just essentially about recognising that 5G is going to give them enormous power for surveillance, digitisation, robotisation. Bad news for us, great for the elite. So don't buy it. If you have to get rid of your phone, get rid of your phone. Landlines, not Wi-Fi. Third days, boycott corporate and government media. This one's crucial because they're controlling the narrative through the media. Government, corporate, boycott it. There's plenty of good progressive news websites around. There's plenty of good radio shows, Tony. You can probably name one. I can. Where you get truthful information or at least a critique or a debate. You get an alternative view. And at the moment, the corporate and government media aren't giving us those alternative views. So yeah, go for the alternative media, including alternative social media. Another one is to do with tackling the banking system. We're suggesting pay with cash as much as you can, get out of the digital banking system, switch to community-owned banks. Most of the world's banking is done through about half a dozen giant banks. We need to go for the local community-owned banks where you're one of the owners of the bank or a credit union, whatever version you have in your country. Get your money back under your control, because if you submit to going into the digitised version, you're going to lose control. Don't wear masks or social distance. Stay human. It's another day. Another one is keep your small business open in lockdown, and we've got to support those small businesses. At the moment, one of the things that's happening is that all the small businesses are being forced out of business. So families that used to make their living running a restaurant or a takeaway or whatever are being forced out, and we're being forced into buying from the big chain stores or the big online stores like Amazon. So we've got to support small and family businesses so that they've got their own little economy working, and we're keeping the diversity of economy that we need if we're going to survive as a society, because at the moment they're locking us into the chain stores and they're using contact tracing like QR codes in Australia. I don't know what's happening over in the UK, but a lot of contact tracing. And we need to resist those as well, because every time we do that, we're participating in their efforts to create this comprehensive surveillance grid. And the last ones, don't pay COVID-related fines, risk becoming a prisoner of conscience. There's a lot of non-violent history on people who've got the courage to resist paying fines and spending a bit of time in jail, making a big difference to campaigns of this nature. And if every time they fine us for not wearing a mask or doing something else they don't like, we pay up the money. All we're doing is surrendering our resources and in effect submitting. So better to be a prisoner of conscience and be someone who's helped to defend our humanity. Bear in mind, this is, as I said earlier, it's really the end game. If we don't win this fight, we're going to enter a second dark age. We're already at the entrance, frankly. And so it can be pretty inspiring to spend time in prison with other people who've got a conscience too. And there's a lot of history on that. And I know it's not the sort of thing the average person even thinks about. This sounds ridiculous, I know. But if we aren't willing to pay a price now, then... Well, those who come after us are not going to be happy with the fact that our lack of courage and our lack of vision and our lack of willingness to resist has made their job tougher. We aren't quite in the dark age yet. Now's the time to fight.
So seven, that's a pretty good 7-day. If we just don't do this, if humanity says, oh, well, we're just going to do what we're told, where are we going to be in a few years' time?
No, we're good, Tony. I mean, again, as I say, I use the term second dark age deliberately. I mean, a time when humans were ignorant and lived in fear and just there was nothing happening. And we talk about the Enlightenment because it was a time when all of a sudden knowledge and things like freedom and human rights and all those things sort of got going. We're at the coalface now of a challenge to stand up or lose everything we've spent really the past 1,000 years fighting to get. And as I say, related to these other threats, you know, that are coming, you know, on the extinction line, like biodiversity collapse and so on, and the threat even from 5G. I mean, we have so many things to fight, but if we don't fight now, there won't be anything to fight for in a very short time. So from my point of view, it's now or never. It's all or nothing. You know, we've got everything to fight for, and we've got to do it now. And I just hope that we can mobilise enough people who are willing to do that, that we can create a human future that's worth leaving to our kids.
Yeah. So your 7 days campaign to resist the Great Reset, which I think is a great way to, package it, really, 7 different ways to do it, is on your transcend.org website, the Worldwide Nonviolent Resistance to Elite Control. Can you just say if there's any other places that people should be looking to find good resources in order to fight this, Robert?
Sure. Yeah, the website, just again to make sure people get it, it's wearehumanwearefree.org. No other dots or dashes. Wearehumanwearefree.org. That's got on it the 7-day campaign. It's got an analysis of what's taking place. It's got a page on resources, which lists a whole range of progressive news sites and what have you. In fact, we'll make a point of adding your program, Tony. And so we're giving people a list of progressive media sites, progressive social media sites, the sort of authors who are writing really good critiques of what's taking place, videos. So if you look at that website, you'll get all the information, the analysis, the strategy, the other resources that you can consult. And we made a point of putting it all there so that it was one easy place for people to check.
Okay, Robert Burrows, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. It's been an enormous pleasure. I really appreciate it.